though, just been breathing in and taking in a bit of a shift in the monastery's cycles and energy and patterns this past week. Since coming back from the Hermitage, where I spent the Vasa with Lungpa Pisano, and then in Agarika Thai, now Samanera Ubasi. It's been kind of a changing whirlwind of different flavors of the monastery coming back and having a nice long visit from Ajahn Amaro, Tanajahn Amaro, overlapping a week-long Katina celebration, many days of Katina festivities, and then a short break, and then the Thanksgiving online retreat, which ended last weekend, I think. And a week of kind of readjusting back to the normal day, the quote-unquote normal daily schedule. And then with Lungpa still in Thailand, continuing his travels for the rest of this month, three senior monks having departed to go spend the winter at the Hermitage, Ajahn Kasapo, Ajahn Chunda, Ajahn Titipano left, and Ajahn Yanako just took off this morning to go for a trip to Brazil to visit our a branch monastery there. Tan Sudiro just returning from 4 years in Thailand. So shifting positions, shifting faces, shifting activities. But the monastery pulse still, one can feel it, and the heart rhythm of the monastery beats away. We keep on doing what we do. People keep tapping in. So all good stuff. One of the core teachings of the Buddha that I've just kind of started turning my attention to a little bit more recently, a theme that we all have visited, I'm sure, to some extent, and will visit again as a theme of contemplation that the Buddha encourages us to engage in frequently, a lot, all the time. Regarding the five khandhas, the five aggregates, and the five khandhas are one of the ways that the Buddha talks about our experience, our conscious experience, and it's a way of kind of describing experience in a way that lends to developing some insight into our reality, our waking, ongoing, daily, moment-to-moment reality, and how we get stuck in it and mired in it and create suffering around these experiences, and how we can use this kind of classification of existence, classification of being or of our normal daily waking reality, how we can use it as a contemplation to help understand how we get entangled and by not seeing clearly. There's, you know, different ways that the Buddha approaches this, like, you know, the five aggregates or the six sense bases, different categories of contemplation of experience. But this tends to be one of the primary ones, and he brought it up, you know, right in the within the first few weeks of his teaching after his enlightenment in the second discourse on the characteristic of not self. The five khandhas play primary role in that kind of exposition analysis. So just briefly, five khandhas: form, feeling, perception, mental or volitional formations, and consciousness. The realms of experience that we tend to heap together and call ourselves, our personhood, personality, our human being, our human beingness, that's a word. Basically, you know, our body and our mind is what these five aggregates refer to. Aggregates, collections, heaps, kind of all various translations of the word khanda, collections. So it's interesting, these five khandhas are it's like they're five separate aggregates in a sense, but each of those aggregates are aggregates too of different aspects of experience. So collection, it's a collection of collections. And the Buddha says if we can start to understand that, then we can start to disentangle ourselves from the whole experience of complication and dukkha, essentially, because there's aspects of the five khandhas in and of themselves, they're just simply that. They're these heaps of experience, you know, flowing from one moment to the next, and we kind of hold on to them, though, or cling to them in a way that kind of makes them all stick together. And they become what's called the upadana khanda, as opposed to just the khanda. They become the upadana khanda, the five aggregates, or the aggregates affected by clinging, upadana. And that's sort of their, kind of points to their, you know, congealed nature, their stuck togetherness. Is held on to as a unit or as a series of units to which we apply this perception of self, of me, I, me, or mine. And that way they're also known as the upadhi, sort of the acquisitions is sometimes how upadhi is translated. Essentially those aspects of our experience that we acquire as our own, ourselves, as I, me, or mine. Sometimes it's called, you know, acquisitions is one translation, or the bases of existence, the bases of being or becoming, are these five aggregates affected by clinging. And that clinging aspect of the upadana khanda is what is that what creates that stickiness, that holding together, and how we operate with it as who we are in some way or another, or as something that we possess in some way or another. And how we are essentially the factors or the underlying tendencies of greed, hatred, and delusion take hold of these khandhas or this experience to use to kind of perpetuate their existence, these underlying tendencies. So I think, you know, a lot of what the teachings point to from the Buddha is how we can kind of unstick these aggregates and kind of make them a little bit more in our awareness, a bit more free-flowing and fluid, and not quite so stuck together. And then if we experience them more in that way, then we don't take them on quite so seriously as who we are or something that we possess. So the goal is to kind of untangle them a bit, tease them out, dissolve some of the glue, so that our waking experience is one that's not tied up and bound up in a kind of manufactured reality of solidity, of personhood, who I am, to kind of tease them apart, experience them without clinging. It doesn't mean that they're gone or that we're trying to annihilate them as the source of our suffering, but just trying to loosen up the grip of personhood, of selfhood, in regards to the five aggregates, the five stuck together heaps of experience. Tease them out, loosen them up, unstick them from each other, and kind of move into more of a flowing relationship as we move through our lives. The Buddha has just a lot of really wonderful images and similes throughout all of the teachings, but particularly in regards to the five khandhas. And, you know, I can't come up very much on my own with good examples and similes, so I just go back to the source. There's several of them that come to mind when I'm thinking about contemplating the khandhas. One is a story. All of these are found in the Khanda Wagga of the Sanyutta Nikaya collection, the collection on the aggregates, the khandhas. And one of them that I've always, they're very dramatic in some ways, and sometimes quite blunt. The Buddha could be quite straightforward in his description, so they're not meant to be like off-putting in a way, but more like engaging and kind of a reality check for us, draw our attention to something like this in a dramatic way. So there's one story where actually it's Venerable Sariputta who's trying to disentangle a certain monk from a pernicious view, a wrong view of that he has about the that when an enlightened being dies, then essentially, you know, an annihilationist view, then that is it. And Venerable Sariputta is kind of trying to disengage him from this annihilationist view. But after he goes through some questioning and this monk, Yamaka, is seen more clearly, then Venerable Sariputta offers a kind of a little story to help illustrate some of this confusion around the five khandhas. And he starts, he says, okay, suppose there's a wealthy man who leads a good life, comfortable life, and, you know, he has a bodyguard and he's got enough money to hire people to look after his needs and his household. And that another man who has evil intentions, desiring things not for this man's welfare, with a wish to murder him. The Buddha never goes into a reason why this this man wants to do this. I haven't really speculated whether he's, you know, kind of just after the householder's money and his possessions, trying to rob him in some way as a thief, or where he's just kind of like a psychopathic killer or whatever. You never quite get the insight into what's motivating this person, but it is a story anyway. Anyway, he comes in to this householder's life and says, "Oh, gee, I'd like to help you out. Can I be your helper, your servant?" And the man says, "Okay, well, you seem like a reasonable fellow. I'll give it a try." So the fellow comes under this man's employment and is really good and is really diligent at what he does. He gets up in the morning before the man arises and gets everything prepared for his day to come. And he's always there and present when he needs to be, and he's anticipating what this man needs and providing it to him with grace and ease and friendliness. And when it's time to go to sleep at night, he always stays up after the man has gone to rest, making sure everything is tended to, and then gets up and rises again in the morning beforehand. And over time, develops a sense of relationship and trust, so that the householder becomes very relaxed and trusting and reliant on this this man who's come into his life to act as his servant. And his suspicion or his wariness or his guardedness in any way disappears, and he just relates to this servant with ease and friendliness and appreciation, and totally relying on him for his well-being. And then once this trust and relationship has been established, the intentions of this man from the beginning that haven't been good are manifested in a moment of when the guard is down, the attention is not there in the householder. The murderer, as he is, takes a knife and stabs him and kills him. And that's it. And so it's a very dramatic little metaphor. And what the Buddha is referring to, or what Sariputta is referring to in this story as an illustration, is how we put our trust and reliance and faith in this body and mind, the five khandhas. We use them for ease and pleasure, and we kind of get fooled, in a sense, into what it is that they are and what it is, the stability that they offer us, and this sense of continuity and this kind of reassurance that we've got a good friend here in this body and mind, and we can rely on it and trust it forever and ever and ever, and everything will be just fine. And in the end, the five khandhas turn around and betray us, and they don't live up to their promises or to what we've imputed as their promises. And in the end, we realize that we've been duped all along. I think it's really good to contemplate on how that happens. The body, we rely on it. It tells us, especially when we're younger and healthier, we kind of get lured into this trust and notion of, oh, okay, well, everything's going fine. I don't really need to be concerned with any problems. The body's, even though it gets a little bit sick every now and then, or you know, has some troubles or some minor problems, it will always right itself. The body is always moving towards, you know, homeostasis. You know, that's, I remember learning that in nursing school. You know, the body's always trying to fight its way back to homeostasis, and it is to some extent. But you know, we get fooled into thinking that that's always going to get healthy again when it does get sick, or that it will remain under our service with only having to do some basic maintenance to keep it going. And then at some point it doesn't get better. You know, like the tendonitis in my big toe that I've had for 2 years, they keep on waiting to heal up. Well, I'm starting to think it's probably going to be here for the rest of the life of this body. Or somehow, you know, some sort of pathogen takes over and thwarts the mechanisms in the body, infection, whatever, or a series of cells go completely berserk and start forming a cancer that is incurable. And the body is betraying us, in a sense. It's not living up to what we thought it was promising. Or feelings, the aggregate of feeling, feeling Vedana being like the feeling tone that's present in every experience of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral tone in our experiential life. And the fact that we always are kind of fooled by the pleasant feeling and thinking, oh, you know, well, if I just, you know, keep on chasing after that which makes me feel good, then that'll give me a long-lasting sense of satisfaction. And, you know, something bad, a bad feeling, an unpleasant feeling comes up with some experience that all we have to do is try and eliminate it, get rid of it, and then we'll be returning back to the promise of good feeling and that sense of satisfaction that comes with that. And so we're kind of fooled by the promise of always gaining satisfaction and contentment through trying to maximize pleasant feeling, minimize painful feeling, and just seeking that which is only pleasurable. Somehow we have this, even though we know that it's not really true, there's this hope that keeps arising moment after moment in the realm of feeling, even though it's constantly changing. Or the perceptions, you know, how we experience the realm of perceptions and how they switch on us, you know, and kind of betray us. So we put faith in that idea of this person in my life being the be-all and the end-all and providing, you know, comfort and security and stability, continuity in my life. And we have that perception of, say, another person or a group of people. And then things change and our perceptions altered. And somebody who was wonderful and a source of great satisfaction and happiness all of a sudden is a different person or has grown and changed or isn't there anymore for some reason. And our whole perceptual world of what these people or these events or these life stories or these experiences will give to us changes. It's a shifting place in the realm of perception, sanya. Or the promise of thoughts, the plans we make, the constructions that we create, the fabrications, sankhara, as the fourth aggregate, you know, the programs we try to write to bring us contentment, satisfaction, stability, the thoughts that we have, and the stories that we tell ourselves, and the plans we make for the future, the way we frame our world based on trying to create that sense of stability. The things that we do, essentially. And then consciousness, that kind of overall quality of just awareness, but which divides into the six sense bases, the six sense bases of consciousness that constantly moves from one to another to weave this illusion of continuity and tie together, in a sense, all the other, the aggregates, all the other khandhas to weave a sense of meanness and solidity and unchangeability, to create a sense of cohesion in our awareness. So, you know, and then at some points that breaks down and reality starts to kind of disassemble and the world isn't quite so stable. And we have a hard time sometimes getting our bearings. So the five khandhas, in the same way as this would-be helper of this man, turn against us, and they don't provide what it is that we feel we've been promised, or that we have been fooled into thinking is going to bring us this kind of everlasting satisfaction. They change on us. Even more dramatically, there's another simile that the Buddha uses that says, you know, like in the past, our form, our body, has devoured us. In the present, it is devouring us. In the future, it too will devour us. In the past, present, and future, our feelings devour us. In the past, present, and future, our perceptions devour us. In the past, present, and future, our sankhara, our mental formations, our fabrications will devour us. And in the past, present, and future, our consciousness aggregate devours us. Devour in the sense of taking in. We've been taken in and consumed by these five aggregates. So it's another very dramatic, very strong way of saying the same thing. So, yes, here we are, being devoured and consumed and betrayed by these five aggregates. And what do we do about it, you know? How can we unstick this? How can we become free from being taken in and fooled by what looks like a very, you know, promising arrangement of components that we've placed our trust in? And to get to that kind of more fluid, flowing, untangled, unsticky understanding of our experience, such that we don't cling to it and hold on to it and expect security and happiness forever. He offers another series of similes that kind of point into how what it is that, how we can view the five aggregates in a way that helps us to see them in more of their in more of a basis of reality, and is pointing towards that lack of selfhood in relation to them, with the classic description of form or the body, the first aggregate, considering it, thinking of it as a lump of foam, which, you know, when we kind of look at the body from a distance or not too carefully, it all looks very solid and substantial, like in the distance, on the seashore, a lump of foam, when you see it in the distance, it kind of appears as something quite tangible and solid. But when you go up to it, look at it closely, it's, you know, very insubstantial. It's mostly air. There's not much substance to it. It's void of any kind of solidity. And that we can view the body in that way too. And you know, we can do that through kind of quieting down and going through an investigation, and kind of teasing apart the various components of the body that give us this impression of a single unit, and kind of examining all the part, like in the 32 parts contemplation, kind of teasing it apart bit by bit, so that it kind of breaks up that solidity. And we begin to see the collection of parts that it really is, and that it's only our perceptual process that pulls them together to form it as a single unit of my body. But really, it's just hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, all the internal organs, the bones, all the liquids, individual components kind of held together in a kind of an amazing way, really, but essentially components that, when they're working very well, give us this sense of unity and solidity and completeness as a thing, and we attach a sense of ownership or self to it, and it all goes just fine until something starts to break down. Even one little component starts to go awry, and it has a chain reaction, and things start to break down, and all of a sudden it's not holding together. So if we can look at it in this way and kind of tease our illusion around it as a single unit that we can possess and control, then our relationship to it becomes very different. It becomes one of just clear knowing. It's still there, it's still doing what it's doing, it's still got its elemental nature to it, it's still functioning along the lines of biology and genetics and those kinds of things, and it's influenced very strongly by mental attitudes, but it's very changeable, it's not very solid, and it's only marginally controllable. It has a life of its own. And so we relate to it in a way that's a little bit more, less clingy and less sticky, and come to be able to step back from it and watch it as a series of processes, a series of experiences that aren't really quite nearly as solid or sticky as they are. They're still there, and we're still affected by them, but they flow. They flow, the experiences of the body flow more easily and independently. You know, we don't have to kind of hold on to them so strongly. Same with feelings of, Buddha talks about feeling tones, these feelings of pleasantness, unpleasantness, neutrality, are like bubbles in a pool of water. When it's raining, the rain hits and the bubble forms. And then it pops, and another bubble forms, and that pops, and it just, that's the nature of feeling, is that feelings are so fleeting. A pleasant feeling arises and soon turns into neutral or unpleasant. It changes. The conditions that are causing the feelings to arise in the body or the mind are constantly morphing and changing. So that we don't really have the ability to establish a true sense of stability around that, and that we see that we see the futility of trying to create only pleasant feeling, which is of course what we want to do, but we see that's just impossible. There can't be that kind of, you know, only having it only one way. The realm of feeling tends to be 50-50, unpleasant and pleasant, or with some range of neutral in between. And that's just the way that nature works with our body and mind. And so we don't try and control it. We don't try and assume a sense of ownership or have any expectation that it's going to be just pleasant. And that way we kind of unstick some of our, you know, our involvement with it and our control over it, or wish to control it. And the perceptions, you know, we see that they're like a mirage. The simile is of a mirage, that from a distance, like a mirage in the desert, a shimmering oasis. But as we get closer to it, and as we see it more clearly, it disappears, and our perceptions are like that. They, you know, they're one way, and we invest in them in a certain way. They appear to us in a certain manner, and we believe in them. These are the patterns that we create for ourselves, the impressions we create around people, around events, around our lives. And then we realize that they're just as fleeting and changeable as anything else, and that one time that we see something as desirable or as a friend or in one light, and it changes into something different, or that person that we thought was so mean and so difficult and such a pain to be with, to live with, and is, you know, kind of a certain way, something changes, or we see them in a different light, and all of a sudden their good qualities come out, and we see them as a completely different being. Well, where did the first perception go? You know, where did that go to? It was a mirage. It kind of shimmered and then disappeared, and something else replaced it. So perceptions are like that. Or the volitional mental formations, the thoughts especially, the thought trains that we jump onto, travel with, like a Buddha describes it as like a plantain plant, or like a, you can think of it as a lot like an onion. So that you keep on peeling off layers, one after another, and when you get to the center of it, there's actually no heartwood, there's no center to it, it's just a series of layers. It's like when you're pursuing an idea or a concept or a thought train, and if you really look at it clearly, when you get right down to trying to find that substance in an idea, in a fabrication, you keep on peeling back layers and layers, and you see that there really is no central core to it. There's no solid reality to the stories that we weave, that they're just kind of collections of words and images that we impute a very solid sense of reality that we try and take refuge in. Create scenarios that will explain our lives or bring us some sort of sense of completion, satisfaction, solidity. And we see that really in the end, that it's just layers that have no substance to them. And then they pass away. They have their life and they pass away. Consciousness is likened to a magician's trick, and the illusion of continuity, that our constantly changing focus from sights, you know, sounds, tastes, smells, tactile sensations, thoughts, intellect, the workings, our attention, you know, consciousness is is created with our attention moving from one of these sense bases to another, constantly, fleetingly, for just one moment to the next, weaving a sense of a waking reality that has some sort of continuity to it. But it's really just an illusion. So, you know, we can start to tease apart our reliance on these five khandhas in this way, to kind of unstick them from each other and kind of loosen up our the way we hold them and the way we cling to them, particularly with this sense of either they're myself, they're who I am, or I have control over them. There is a me or some sort of self that has possession and control over these five khandhas, the five heaps that are glued together. Kind of loosen the glue through this perceptual shifting, through the watching the changing nature and the examining the insubstantiality of them, so that we're just not fooled by them any longer. We see them for what they are. And again, it's not like trying to annihilate them or get rid of them, but trying to just disentangle the experience so that we don't hold this body and mind with a tightness and a narrowness that our greed, hatred, and delusion has control over. And as we're doing that, as we see that, then actually what comes to replace the controlling forces of greed, hatred, and delusion is what replaces that is wisdom and clarity. So that more and more the discernment, clear seeing, sampajanya, panya, seeing them as they truly are, becomes more of the controlling nature, and the identification and the holding kind of loosens up, and the body just becomes this series of activities, of sensations and experiences on a physical level, tactile level. The elements, it becomes loosened up and more of an experience of just the elemental nature expressing itself through the body and the feelings and the perceptions and the thoughts and emotions and consciousness all kind of start to be seen just as events. These are all events happening. They're not solid and unchanging. Our whole world of experience, our world of body and mind, are events. It's an event stream that we don't have to hold on to. We can be with them, and we let good qualities inform them and manifest how they work in the world and how we respond to them. But it's wisdom eventually that we let be in charge rather than attraction, aversion, craving, delusion, confusion. And then things have the opportunity to just kind of loosen up and unstick from each other and flow in a more natural way. So, you know, the Buddha says, whatever it is that's not yours, abandon it. You know, what is it that's not yours? The body isn't yours, form isn't yours, feelings are not yours, perceptions are not yours, mental formations are not yours, consciousness is not yours. Whatever isn't yours, abandon them, let them go. Don't try and hold on to them. There's a simile that the Buddha uses also about all the sticks and foliage and branches and matter of vegetable matter in Jeta's Grove. If people were taking them away, you were watching them taking away the sticks and foliages and branches and all that kind of stuff and taking them away, burning them or using them, would you say, stop, stop, you know, you're taking me away, you're taking me away? No, you wouldn't say that because it's just the sticks and branches of foliage of Jeta's crow. It's not who you are. In the same way, you should regard these five khandhas as those sticks and branches and foliage of Jeta's crow. And they're not yours. So you don't have any right to possess them or protest when they get taken away. I can't remember whether it was Ajahn Buddhadasa or someone else who was saying, you know, sort of like, hey, you know, you're a thief. You've stolen these five khandhas. You've taken them on to be your own. They're not yours. It's time to give them back. Time to give them back to nature, which is where they belong. So that's one way that we can contemplate these five aggregates that we take to be who we are, as a way of kind of disentangling ourselves from being slave to them. And then we can live with them in kind of appreciation for what they offer. But we don't have to be taken in by them or fooled by them or impute any kind of solidity or permanence, security onto them, but we use them for contemplation in a way of disentangling ourselves from clinging and the suffering that comes from that. And then the upadana khanda, the aggregates affected by clinging, can relax and just become the aggregates not affected by clinging. They're just what they are. And we can know them as they arise, as they persist, and as they change, pass away, and be freed from entanglement. So just a few thoughts for contemplation on this night, and I'll leave it for there for the time.